Well, turn with me again, please, to the passage that we read a moment ago. Genesis chapter 30, verse 25 to chapter 31, verse 21. As we continue then our studies in the life of Jacob. Now, the beginning of this passage marks really a very significant moment in the life of Jacob. Some time ago, Hannah received a very welcome letter in the post. It didn't look at first sight like it was going to be very exciting. It was one of these very unexciting looking typed envelopes, which you expect is going to be a bill or an announcement that the gas prices are rising or something like that. But in actual fact, its contents were, as I say, very welcome. It was a letter from the student loans company. And it went something like this: "Dear Mrs. Peters, congratulations, you have completed paying off your student loan." Perhaps you have received a letter like that in the past. Perhaps you've received that even more enviable letter: "Congratulations, you have finished paying off your mortgage." And you'll know if you have the kind of excitement that that engenders. It was all I could do to stop Hannah going away and framing this letter and putting it up on the living room wall. And I think that it must have been something of that kind of excitement which Jacob felt at the outset of this passage. He had just completed at last the 14 years of service which he owed Laban for his two wives, Leah and Rachel. 14 years, think of it. It's shorter, I admit, than most mortgages, but a good bit longer than most student loans. 14 years. The first 7 years, of course, we know, had seemed to Jacob like only a few days because he was so much in love with Rachel. The second 7 years, however, must have seemed more like a few decades to him, not because he was any the less in love with Rachel, but because those 7 years were dominated by a proliferation of wives that Jacob never really wanted, and by the problems of family growth and pregnancies in that context of having four wives. But here at last then, the 14 years are over. They've gone. They've finished. And how then does Jacob mark this occasion? Does he hold a huge party? Does he crack open the champagne? No. He gets up this morning and he has only one thing in mind. He strides out in search of his father-in-law Laban. And when he finds him, he expresses to him quite unequivocally his desire now to leave Haran and to return home to Canaan. And so, as I say, it's a very significant moment in the life of Jacob. He's been there in Haran for 14 years, but now he's approached his father-in-law and he's expressed a desire to return home. And so this evening then I'd like us just to follow through how the events unfold, how they develop from this significant point in Jacob's life. And I'd like us to do that under three headings. First of all this evening, Laban's blessing. Laban's blessing. What then is Laban's response as Jacob comes to him and expresses, as I say, his intention to leave Haran and go back to Canaan? Well, notice what he says in verse 27. He says to him, "If I have found favor in your eyes, please stay. I have learned by divination," and I think that's a rather dubious translation actually, but we won't go into that this evening. It's the next bit I want you to notice. "I have learned by divination that the Lord has blessed me because of you." The Lord has blessed me because of you. And this is an assessment of things which Jacob himself agrees with, doesn't he, later on in verse 30. "The Lord has blessed you wherever I have been." Now, we've noticed in our previous studies the parallels that seem to exist almost between the generations here in this book of Genesis, so that Jacob's journey out there to Haran to find a bride, has a parallel, doesn't it? A generation earlier, when Abraham's servant went out to Haran to find a bride for Isaac. And in a similar way, this detail here of Laban being blessed through Jacob, that has a parallel a generation later, when you come to chapter 39, and you read there in the context of Joseph, the Lord blessed, this is in verse 5 of Genesis 39, the Lord blessed the household of the Egyptian, that is Potiphar, because of Joseph. The blessing of the Lord was on everything Potiphar had, both in the house and in the field. And in the light of this, then, we must ask the question, what exactly is this phenomenon? This phenomenon of outsiders in remote lands, whether Haran or Egypt, being blessed through the presence of Abraham's offspring in their midst. What is this? Is it just coincidence that it happens in Jacob's experience and it happens a generation later in Joseph's experience? Is it just coincidence, or is something else going on here? And I think the answer is that these are small, flickering fulfillments of that promise which God had given to Abraham right back at the beginning, there in Genesis chapter 12 and verse 3. All peoples on earth will be blessed through you. And then, of course, he had reiterated that promise to Abraham in Genesis 22. Through your offspring, all nations on earth will be blessed. And not only that, but then God had announced the same promise, basically, to Jacob in that dream at Bethel in chapter 28. All peoples on earth will be blessed through you and your offspring. And these incidents then, here in chapter 30 and in chapter 39, of Laban on the one hand being blessed through Jacob, and then Potiphar on the other hand being blessed through Joseph. Those, I think, are, as I say, small, flickering fulfillments of that promise. Now, they are only small, flickering fulfillments. We're only talking here at the end of the day about one isolated household in Haran and one isolated household in Egypt. And when we talk about blessing, all we're talking about here is a spell of financial prosperity which both Laban and Potiphar experienced. At the end of the day, it doesn't really amount to that big a deal. But you see, in these incidents, God, I think, is pointing forward, albeit opaquely and in shadowy terms, but he's pointing forward to the real and full and final fulfillment of that promise. Because you see, many centuries later, the ultimate descendant of Abraham would step onto the stage of history. And he would live a life on this earth of 30 odd years. Most of those 30 odd years would be very confined and contained geographically. He made one foray into Egypt, but that was as a helpless baby in his parents' arms. But then, at the end of those 30-odd years, he would be killed. 3 days later, he would rise again from the dead. A little bit later still, he would ascend into heaven. And virtually since that moment, from then onwards, literally, the nations have been blessed because of him. So that you can go today in 2007 to South Korea and you will find millions of people blessed because of Jesus. You can go to India and you will find millions of people blessed because of Jesus. You can go to Nigeria and you will find millions of people blessed because of Jesus. You can even look around the United Kingdom and you will see hundreds of thousands at least blessed because of Jesus. And so I'm saying then that as we look at this passage and as we see Laban here, blessed on account of having Abraham's descendants present in his midst, blessed on account of having Jacob there in his presence. When we see that, our hearts should leap, because we're seeing there a little foreshadowing, a tiny foreshadowing of all the blessings that would later come to us through Abraham's greater descendant, Jacob's greater descendant, Jesus Christ. The blessings of forgiveness of sin and peace with God, salvation from sin and death and hell. All those blessings have come to us through Jesus Christ. And we're seeing a little foreshadowing of that then in what happens to Laban here. So that's the first thing to notice, Laban's blessing. But secondly, God's deliverance. God's deliverance. Now, this reality then that we've just been noticing of Laban being so blessed on account of having Jacob in his midst, it may have spelled great news for Laban. It may spell great news for us, because as we've just said, in it we see a foreshadowing of our own blessings that we experience through Jesus Christ. But it didn't spell great news for Jacob, because it meant, of course, that Laban was most reluctant to let him go back to Canaan. He was experiencing all this unprecedented blessing because of Jacob. There was no way that he was likely going to wave goodbye to him and allow him to return home. And so he says, doesn't he, in verse 28, "Name your wages and I will pay them." In other words, Laban is saying to Jacob, look, don't go off. Don't go back to Canaan. Stay here with me. Remain in my service here. Look, we'll negotiate a new contract. We'll negotiate new terms, new conditions. You stay here with me. Remain in my service. And at first sight, this may appear a very understandable and a very harmless response on Laban's part. Indeed, you almost can't help but be impressed by the sheer niceness of this man. In verse 27, "If I have found favor in your eyes, please stay." He seems such a pleasant and nice fellow, doesn't he? But I think that in actual fact, there's something really quite sinister about this. You see, what you have to understand is that Jacob couldn't simply walk out on Laban no matter what. He couldn't simply decide that regardless of anything else, he was going to leave Haran and go home. Well, why not, you say? He's done his 14 years of service. He doesn't owe Laban anything now. And that's true. And it's not because he owes Laban something that he can't simply leave Laban and go back home. It's rather because Jacob isn't economically self-sufficient. Over these past 14 years, all he has been doing is paying off a debt. He hasn't been accumulating any wealth whatsoever for himself. He hasn't accumulated so much as a single sheep, a single goat for himself. And if he then is going to make this journey all the way back to Canaan, accompanied by 4 wives, 11 sons and 1 daughter, then he is going to have to find some capital from somewhere. If he's going to keep all this family of his fed and clothed and all the rest of it, he needs some income. And that's why, you see, he addresses Laban as he does in verse 25. He doesn't simply go into Laban's office and say, "Right, Laban, I'm off." He says, "Send me on my way so that I can go back to my own homeland." He's saying, in other words, "Laban, will you give me a golden handshake, effectively? Will you give me a large, generous send-off so that this journey that I intend to make with my large family will be a viable one?" And there was nothing unreasonable about Jacob's request there. Indeed, later on, of course, it became enshrined in Israel's law that if you had a slave working for you, in the 7th year, you had to release that slave. And not only did you have to release him, but you had to give him a generous send-off. Well, here's Laban, and he's had Jacob working for him for 14 years. Jacob certainly deserved a generous send-off. And so you see, when Laban says to Jacob there in verse 28, "Name your wages and I will pay them," it may seem very reasonable, it may seem very polite, it may seem almost complimentary to Jacob. "Look, I don't want to get rid of you." But In reality, Laban is saying to Jacob, no, I'm not going to give you that golden handshake. I'm not going to give you that large, generous send-off. And by saying that, he was effectively slamming the door shut on the very possibility of Jacob going back to Canaan. And so Jacob seems to be trapped, really. It's true, of course, that in verse 31, Laban seems to change his mind. He says, well, what shall I give you? He seems now to be coming round to the idea, yes, I will give you a generous send-off. But it's interesting, isn't it, that Jacob doesn't take him up on it now. I think that Jacob probably has realized from Laban's initial instinctive response in verses 27 and 28 that he's still basically the same greed-driven man he was 7 years ago. And this offer now in verse 31 probably amounts to nothing more than another trick up his sleeve, another cunning deception, another leer, another substitute, useless substitute for what Jacob really wants. And so, as I say, Jacob is trapped. He can't go back. He hasn't got the means, he hasn't got the finances, he hasn't got the capital, he hasn't got the resources to set off back to Canaan. He's trapped there. We saw back in chapter 27, at the end of that chapter, that Jacob's prospects of ever settling down in the land of Canaan seemed very remote. Why? Well, Canaan had become a no-go area for him. His brother Esau was there, and his brother Esau wanted to kill him. But then, of course, after that, in chapter 28 at Bethel, God had appeared to Jacob and had promised him explicitly that he would go back to Canaan and settle there. And yet here we are now, and it's chapter 30, and the prospect of Jacob settling in Canaan seems more remote than ever. Now it's no longer his brother Esau that's the main problem. He's an unknown quantity now. We don't know whether he's still harboring the murderous desires 14 years down the line. But now it's his uncle and his father-in-law Laban that's the main problem. He's got Jacob trapped. He's got him leashed. He's got him enslaved there in Haran, miles away from the land that God had promised him. Things really do now seem to be bleaker than ever for Jacob. His circumstances seem to have hit a new low. He seems to have hit rock bottom. But God was still committed to keeping the promise he had made to him at Bethel. God was still committed to returning Jacob to the land of Canaan. Let's follow through what happens and what we have initially. Is in verses 31 and following, is Jacob making the most stupid proposal imaginable to his father-in-law Laban. Now, this section of the passage you may have found a little complicated as we read it. Some of you are in your third service of the day tonight, and you may not have followed everything in this passage. So let me try and explain as clearly as I can what Jacob's proposal to Laban was here. He was basically saying to Laban, look, what we'll do is this. We'll remove from your flocks, the flocks that I'm looking after for you, Laban, because I'm your shepherd, I'm your servant, I'm your slave. We'll remove from those flocks every multicolored sheep and every multicolored goat. Every animal that's spotted or flecked or whatever, every animal that has more than one coloring in it. Will remove those animals from the flock. And then what we'll do is this. With the flocks that I'm left with, which are just single-colored animals, animals that are pure black, pure white, any multicolored animals that are born in that flock, I'll keep. So any multicolored animals that are born in this single-colored flock will be mine. I'll keep them. Now that, as I say, it was a stupid, stupid proposal to make on the face of things. Because although probably one or two multicolored animals would be born in that context, there weren't going to be many. Because the majority of the offspring of that flock were going to be the same as their parents. They were going to be single-colored. And so Jacob was hardly going to get any animals to keep for himself. It was going to take him 1 million years to build up a flock that was large enough to be of any use to him whatsoever. It seemed an utterly, utterly ridiculous proposal. And as you can imagine, Laban is delighted with it. He thinks he's really struck gold here, and so he agrees immediately in verse 34, and so the proposal is implemented. And it's at that point that Jacob's behavior becomes even more bizarre. And now he begins to even dictate the mating habits of the animals that are in his care. And again, you may not have followed exactly what was going on here, and indeed, it's not easy to decipher all the details, but basically, he did two things. First of all, he got a load of branches, tree branches. And from these branches, he stripped off a section of the bark. Not the whole of the bark, but just a section of the bark. And you know yourself that with some trees, if you do that, it's bright white underneath. And so that's what he did. And having done that then, he ended up with a pile of multicolored branches, essentially. Branches that were both dark because of the bark, but also bright white where the bark had been stripped off. And then he got the animals to mate in front of those multicolored branches on the basis that if they were looking at the multicolored branches when they mated, they would produce multicolored offspring. And he would be able to keep those. Those would be his. That was the first thing he did. The other thing he did was he made sure it was only strong animals that mated in that way. A strong male, a strong female that mated in front of the multicolored branches so that all the multicolored offspring that he was able to keep would be strong animals. That is what he did. And it's as you're reading through this passage then, shaking your head pityingly at poor old Jacob here. He's just gone nuts, it seems. He's gone bonkers. You're waiting for the men in the white coats to come and take this man away. That suddenly you come to verse 43. In this way, the man grew exceedingly prosperous and came to own large flocks. It worked. This stupidest proposal imaginable worked. Multicolored animals were produced right, left, and center by these single-colored flocks. And Jacob was keeping animals, right, left, and center. He was building up flocks and flocks of them. He had more animals than he knew what to do with. It worked. And he got richer and richer. And crucially, of course, he got himself into a position in which he had the resources to be able to leave home, to be able to leave Haran, and go home. He was no longer dependent now on Laban, no longer dependent now on him giving him a large, generous, golden handshake. Now he could do it in his own right. He had the resources. He had developed all these flocks. Well, it's when we move into chapter 31 that we discover that God was behind this. God was behind it. In verse 4, Jacob sends for his two wives. Of course, if he's going to leave Haran now and go back to Canaan, he needs to get his wives on side. They need to be agreeable to this project. And so he summons his wives out into the fields. He probably wants to speak to them there, so he's out of earshot of everyone else. And he tries to persuade them to come with him on this journey. And he begins his speech to them by talking about how their father Laban has treated him so unfairly over the years. But then in verses 10 to 13, we discover that lying behind these strange animal breeding antics of the previous chapter had been a dream. God had again appeared to Jacob in a dream. And in this dream, God had expressed his sympathy for Jacob. Verse 12, I have seen all that Laban has been doing to you. And in this dream, God had indicated the miraculous means by which he was going to deliver Jacob from Laban's grasp. But there's these references out there in verse 10 and verse 12 to these multicolored animals, which, defying all the odds and against nature, were going to start teeming within the flocks of Jacob. And so, do you see what's going on here? what had been happening out there on the hillsides of Haran. Wasn't Jacob demonstrating some remarkable gift he had in the field of genetic engineering? This was God demonstrating his remarkable commitment to his promise, delivering Jacob, this enslaved exile in a foreign land, and enabling him to return to Canaan. I wonder, does that remind you of anything? Does it remind you perhaps of what happened a few centuries later when God demonstrated his commitment to his promise and delivered the children of Israel, enslaved exiles in a foreign land, and enabled them to return to the land of Canaan? There are a number of interesting parallels. Just as in here in chapter 31, verses 10 to 13, God appeared to Jacob in a dream. So in Exodus 3, he appears to Moses at the burning bush. Just as to Jacob here, he expresses his sympathy. I have seen all that Laban has been doing to you. So in Exodus 3, at the burning bush, to Moses, I have seen what has been done to you in Egypt. And just as he indicates to Jacob here in verses 10 to 13, the miraculous means by which he was going to deliver Jacob from Laban. So in Exodus chapter 3, verse 20, I will stretch out my hand and strike the Egyptians with all the wonders that I will perform among them. But then, don't both of these Old Testament incidents remind us of something much bigger still? Don't they remind us of God's great eternal plan of redemption? And the way in which he is about the business of delivering an innumerable multitude of enslaved exiles. Exiles from the paradise, from the Eden in which he originally created them, and enabling them to return to paradise, to Eden, to ultimately restored heavens and a restored earth. If God saw what Laban was doing to Jacob, and if God saw what the Egyptians were doing to the children of Israel, how much more he has regarded our helpless estate, as we sang earlier. And if God's means of delivering Laban was miraculous, and if God's means of delivering the Israelites from Egypt was miraculous, how much more miraculous his means of delivering us through the enfleshment of his own Son in the womb of the Virgin Mary, through the cursing of his Son on the cross of Calvary, through the raising of his Son from the dead on the third day. And so I'm saying then that once again, as we look at this obscure and odd Old Testament narrative, again our hearts should leap. Because in this dramatic turnaround, Jacob's dramatic turnaround from being an enslaved exile to being a pilgrim on his way home to Canaan, we see the basic shape of our own turnaround from being enslaved exiles in this world without God and without hope to being pilgrims on our way to glory. God's deliverance, that's the second thing that we see here. But thirdly and finally, Jacob's flight. Jacob's flight. Laban's blessing, God's deliverance, Jacob's flight. Just, it's the last few verses, isn't it, of verse 31 of chapter 31 then. And Jacob has persuaded Rachel and Leah, and so there's nothing left in their way, and they begin the journey back. But I just want to notice two things in these verses. And they're things of a more practical nature, I suppose. So far, we've been thinking in big terms of God's redemption and God's redemptive plan, but just two more practical notes on which to close. First of all, notice the sad impression Laban left on his daughters. The sad impression that Laban left on his daughters. In verses 14 and 15, Rachel and Leah replied, "Do we still have any share in the inheritance of our father's estate? Does he not regard us as foreigners? Not only has he sold us, but he has used up what was paid for us." And there seems to me something desperately sad about this. This is the impression that Laban has left on his daughters, they having grown up in his household. The impression, basically, that money is more important to him than they are. The impression that they are basically just commodities to him, of use in the accumulation of his finances, the accumulation of his bank balance, the success of his business projects. That's the impression that they have. They've spent all these years growing up in this man's family, and their abiding impression is that money was more important to their father than they were. And I have a feeling that there are many children in our own society today who probably have received that impression as well. They've received the impression that money is more important to their parents than they are. And I have a feeling there may well be many children in Christian homes in our society today, in evangelical churches, who also have received the impression that money is more important to their parents than they are. As they see their parents working around the clock, their dads constantly going off to the next business meeting, seeing the next client, going off on the next trip abroad, going off on the next business function, and having barely any time whatsoever to spend with them, to spend getting to know them, to spend teaching them the Bible, to spend showing them in just practical living what it is to be a Christian. Many children in Christian families too, I'm sure, receive that impression. And we must be careful then, in a society that is work-obsessed, where money is everything, where work is everything, where having the right home and the right car and the right look and everything else is so important, we must be careful that we don't leave our children with the impression that those things are more important to us than they are. But then the other thing to notice is Rachel's theft of her father's gods, this little detail that we're told of at the end of the passage. Now, there's a fair bit of debate as to what exactly this was about, what precisely was the function that these gods played within Laban's household, and so what was Rachel's motive, therefore, in taking them. But I think it's clear that whatever other motives may have been there as well, there was a religious motive involved here. Rachel took these gods because, to some degree, she felt the need of them. She felt the need to rely upon them. She felt that they would be of help to her as she stepped off in this journey into the unknown with Jacob and the rest of the family. And I suppose our instinctive reaction, therefore, is to be very harsh on Rachel and to say, well, what a silly thing to do. How much of a shame it is that she couldn't just rely upon Jehovah. She couldn't place all her trust in him. What a shame that she couldn't find it in her just to lean solely upon him. She needed to steal these gods of her father. And that is reasonable enough. But I just wonder how much Rachel was influenced here by her husband Jacob. Now, I don't mean that Jacob told her to go and steal these gods. He certainly didn't. We find out in the next section that, in fact, he knew nothing about the theft. But there's that interesting detail, isn't there, in verse 20. "Moreover, Jacob deceived Laban the Aramean by not telling him he was running away." And there's something very sad about that. Here's Jacob, and as we've seen tonight, he has been blessed here immeasurably by God. God has enabled him in this miraculous way to get into a position where he can leave Haran and go back to Canaan. It must have been obvious to Jacob that God was with him, that God was blessing him, God was on his side, God was behind this idea of him going back home. And yet, it appears that at the last moment, he still didn't have the nerve. He still didn't have the courage to do the proper thing and the appropriate thing and to go and tell Laban squarely what he was doing. Instead, he furtively and secretly legged it while Laban was out shearing the sheep. And I wonder then whether it was the sight of Jacob becoming here so edgy, so jumpy, and resorting to this deception, whether it was the sight of that that made Rachel so edgy and so jumpy and made her resort to stealing the household gods and relying on them. When she saw that her husband didn't have that much confidence really in Jehovah as he set off on this journey back, then she felt, well, I can't really have that much confidence in him either. I better take these gods as well. And I think, again, it's particularly challenging that for those of us who are husbands and fathers, those of us who are heads of homes, the influence that we have almost unwittingly and inadvertently. You see, we would never tell our children to be atheists. Of course we wouldn't. But then, if our children see us in the middle of crises and when there's big decisions on our plates and God's hardly in the picture, we're not praying to him, we're not taking him into account, we're living as practical atheists, then can we expect anything more than that they will become fully blown atheists? That's what we're seeing here. Jacob just inadvertently having this harmful influence on his wife by being deceptive, and his practical idolatry led to her fully fledged, fully blown idolatry. And I think we must be very careful, as I say, as those who have influence on others, whether it's our wives, our children, whoever it might be, that our practical godlessness, our practical atheism, our practical idolatry doesn't lead to fully blown idolatry and godlessness and atheism in them. Well, may God help us to learn the lessons of this passage. Amen.